morning. This is Armand DeMille with you with a positive mind here on WBAI 99.5 on your dial. New York City, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests help you lead a positively minded life. We're loaded in the studio today, loaded with caretakers, loaded with them, caregivers, caretakers, everywhere. We've got Linda Vanella, who assists me, and we've got Gianna Valerio, who is also assisting. These are assisting, which is caretakers. And we've got Lisa Arnone, who's joined us recently, who for a profession helps people who are caregivers. But besides all that, we also have Diana Denholm back with us. Dr. Diana, are you with us?
I certainly am, and thank you so much for having me return.
Are you back from Paris?
Yeah. Don't I wish. I'm back from laryngitis, actually.
So we'll be gentle on your voice. The program we did on Monday got a lot of positive feedback, mainly from people talking about how captivated they are by what we've been talking about, how they always wind up in one position or another, you know, last Tuesday, how we wind up in one situation or another, either being caretakers to children, caretakers to parents, caretakers to mates, you know, and then eventually maybe even being on the side, the other side of it. It's like all of us have this complex, you know.
Here I come to save the day. That means that Mighty Mouse is on the way. Yes, sir, when there is a wrong to right, Mighty Mouse will join the fight.
Makes us feel like such heroes to be caretakers, to be generous, to be good, to take the situation in hand and take control. On one hand, we're going to start off the program today by a question by Lisa. Lisa says what she has to face most. And then I'm going to give that question to you, Diana, to talk about. Lisa, what was that question about leaving?
What do we think about a person who's a caregiver who walks away, a person who chooses to walk away when there with somebody who needs to be taken care of? How do we feel about them? Do we admire them? Do we envy them? Do we judge them harshly? And if we're judging them harshly, are we judging ourselves?
I'm going to leave that with you, Diana. Diana, the choice. You know, the choice that a person has. Somebody you're with gets something wrong with them. It could be a severe cancer. It could be alcoholism. It could be any number of things. You have to make a decision. Am I going to stick around for this or am I going to leave? Now, most of us believe you don't have that choice.
You absolutely do have the choice. And it's not uncommon, more so with caregiving husbands, that the marriage will end in divorce. But I'd like to take all judgment out of it, even though we will be judgmental because we're human. But some of the women that I worked with in the Caregiving Wives Handbook had been such intense caregivers that they were becoming ill. And their husbands weren't always wonderful to them. Some were, some weren't. And they went to their physicians, and their physicians told them, quite frankly, in several occasions, if it's a choice between you and your husband, you have to leave because you're going to end up with two dead people. So if we can remove that judgment from it and let these people determine what it is they need to do for themselves. And if I could borrow everyone's imagination for a short time, because in your audience you have wonderful caregivers and you have people who care about caregivers. So for people who are not driving in their car right now, I'd like to borrow your imagination and have you close your eyes for a moment so that you can think a little bit about this. Remember the first time you played pin the tail on the donkey? Remember being blindfolded and spun around? It's a little scary being blinded and disoriented in a strange room, floundering about, having no idea of where you are or where you're going. You're unfamiliar with the room, so you're not sure what obstacles might be there, let alone where they might be. And since you've never played before, you aren't quite sure what's expected of you, and it's quite unsettling. To make it worse, people are watching and evaluating your every move. Some people might be mean and trip or push you because that's just who they are. Others might unintentionally do things that distract you, causing you to falter. Maybe they drop something and it startles you, causing you to lose your balance. Others might try to be helpful. They make a lot of noise to guide you. You might hear them say, go to the left, go forward, go right. But that makes it even harder to find and to keep your bearings. You may stumble and fall, but you do everything in your power to hold on to that tail, the one with the dangerous pin sticking out of it. You wish it would just hurry up and be over. And that's what caregiving is like, except the stakes are much higher, and there isn't a nice prize at the end. So when we look at these people who have to make a decision for their own health and their own well-being, maybe we can, you know, think of this example of pin the tail on the donkey and realize that it's not an easy one for them. In any illness, it does not happen in a vacuum. The illness happens in an existing marriage, in an existing relationship. So whatever was going on before is going to be amplified when the person is sick.
No, some people actually go out and find somebody who is who needs help, and they go to take care of them. They get together with them because they need help. Like, you know, alcoholism or drug addiction or something like that. Some people select it, not from an existing relationship, but they select it just for the fact that that's what they're attracted to.
Right. Well, then you're dealing with an issue of codependency rather than the typical caregiving with an illness.
And we're going to have to talk about that as well. But let's go back to Lisa's question about leaving, right? So here's the question. Let's say you're a caregivee, and you say to yourself, as a caregivee, one who receives care, I know, knowing my mate, that if he takes care of me, he's going to hate me for it. I know that because I've been a shrink, because I understand about caregiving, and I know that they're going to resent me for it. I know, as a wife, I know that if my husband now waits on me hand and foot and takes care of all the medicine, he's going to resent me. He's going to be talking to me with resentment, with a little bit of hatred, a little bit of disgust. I want to keep my husband because I love him. But I know that if he continues to take care of me, he's going to dislike me. So I take responsibility as the sick person to make sure my husband isn't the one who's taking care of me. I make sure somebody else is in the middle so that I don't get that resentment from him. Now, that would be the call that somebody would make if they were you, Lisa. You know, if they were if you were somebody who said, I know the way this works. To have somebody taking care of me is going to be costly. I have to interrupt it. So the choice becomes for the person on the other side, the caretaker. They have a choice. They're either going to leave or they're going to stay with resentment. It's almost inevitable.
They'll give you more options. And what the Caregiving Wife's Handbook is about is options and choices, whether you're caring for a husband or a wife or anyone.
Okay.
Because rather than leaving or staying and have resentment, you can use some of the strategies in the Caregiving Wife's Handbook so that you can begin effective communication, so that you can start creating agreements about how things will be handled, how the care is going to be handled, who is going to be allowed to visit, what the nature of those visits will be, how you're going to handle finances, how you're going to handle every element of the illness and life during that time, so that the resentment doesn't have to occur. If someone can find that, gee, rather than having to take care of my husband's bedpans, that we hire someone to come in and do that, you solve that little problem, and the resentment goes out the window with it. So the whole idea is to prepare ahead of time, or as each circumstance comes up, so that you do not have these things where it's either leave or stay in resentment, because that's not the ideal.
Do you know of anybody who's ever done that successfully?
Yeah, absolutely. Last time you spoke about that the ideas in my book were good in theory, And yet the ideas and all the tools in the handbook have been in use for a number of years. They've been used by many of my clients, not just for the caregiving, but in communication in general to make their relationships work. So absolutely, this is not theory. This is very practical, down-to-earth, how-to advice that absolutely works.
How do you know, as a caregivee, when your caregiver is beginning to hate you? How do you know?
You may not. Hopefully you'll... Well, let me take the side of the caregiver a little bit for a moment. Now, are we talking about, you know, and this is a rhetorical question, alcoholism, a chronic illness? Or are we talking about somebody who's dying? And
let's just say a chronic illness that gets worse.
Because that's different. Because in the handbook, it's really about people with terminal illness. And when the person, you know, is dying, their capacity to be figuring out all this stuff and, you know, being so concerned about another people, they're just trying to stay alive one more day. So they're not going to be able to do it. If you've got somebody else with some other chronic condition, you know, again, they're going to be wrapped up in what's going on with them, and they may never pick up on
it. What about with your 85-year-old mother who's just begun drinking and is starting to fall down occasionally and hurt herself? You know, I mean, it was the beginning of Alzheimer's. How about that kind of caretaking with caretakee, you know?
So you're asking how that 85-year-old...
Yeah, where does that fit in? Is that a temporary illness? Is that a terminal illness?
If that's going into Alzheimer's, then that's going to be terminal.
You call that terminal.
But your point is that the caregivee should be able to spot when others are getting angry with her disgusted, and, you know, they may or they may not. And again, if they are, they also can use these sound communication methods to, you know, bring out the concerns, have a discussion about them in a way that's effective and productive.
Let me see. Linda has something to say about this. Linda, how do you know when you're beginning to resent it? How does it change a person's, the way they're functioning with their caregiver?
I think oftentimes a person who is caring for someone and is growing resentfully may become cool, more aloof, more impatient, have less tolerance, ask for more help, more participation from the person who they're giving care to. And I think that there would be some sign from the person who is ill that might see that there is maybe a lack of empathy, a lack of softness, a lack of affection, but that there's something going on that maybe the caregiver is struggling with.
So the caregiver would have to notify and recognize this, because the caregivee is probably too far gone to even recognize it, and the next thing he or she knows is they're being hated.
For sure. I think the responsibility does really rest on the caregiver more so than the caregivee.
So it goes back to Lisa's question, why don't you just get out instead of doing it? Why don't you just get out? So you've got a mother who's getting old, who's getting Alzheimer's. What does society say about you saying, well, put my mother in a home, I don't want to have anything to do with it?
Well, I think people struggle with that consistently, and I'm sure Diana can speak on that. I know myself, I've run into many people who really struggle with that decision, but that's something that I think the person has to really come to terms with themselves in order to be able to make such a decision, because oftentimes those values are so deep within you that it's something that you have to really come to peace with yourself and hopefully with the family to make decisions like that. But I think those are really kind of difficult decisions, to say the least.
I know a man who had a mother who had a heart attack. And she had this heart attack, and he was very worried about her. And he went to his therapist, and he said, she had a heart attack, I'm afraid to leave her alone, because I'm afraid she's going to have another heart attack, because she's going to be alone, and she might have a heart attack, and be nobody there to take care of her. And the therapist said, okay, you better be there tonight and tomorrow. And forget about tomorrow night. You better be there tomorrow night. He said, you better be there every morning, afternoon, and evening. for the rest of your life if you really want to be able to control this, to be there during that time. Well, that's a really interesting choice. What makes us choose to give up a portion of our lives to take care of somebody else when we do have a choice? And do we have this choice? And I want to ask Diana, do people exercise the choice of saying, I'm not going to do it, even though I should be doing it?
Oh, absolutely. But I agree that it certainly is a very personal choice, and that it does rest with the caregiver rather than the caregivee to be able to sort all this stuff out. My husband had a heart transplant, and part of being eligible for it, you have to prove that you have caregivers around you who will be supportive throughout the whole process and after. And I recall one man who received a heart about the same time my husband did. His wife left him as soon as he got his heart. She obviously had made an agreement with him that she would stay around long enough to make him eligible to get the heart. But then she'd had enough, and she left. And I think we really have to be careful about judging. One of the things that I'm sure all of you listeners and guests on the show will agree is that whatever you do, somebody isn't going to like it. No matter what it's about, no matter, how you're doing it, good, bad, indifferent, somebody isn't going to like it, and they're going to have an opinion on it.
Mm.
And it really doesn't matter what somebody else thinks. Yes, you do have to communicate within your family and friend group in terms of, having your expectations and agreements about what's happening, but it really doesn't matter what somebody else thinks. What you think is what's important, and caregivers have to take care of themselves. And it isn't our job to make anybody else happy. We cannot do it. And the only person we can ever be in charge of is ourselves.
But there's a thing there. What frequently happens is, let's say somebody, like a mother who's ailing, who's got oncoming Alzheimer's or dementia, sees her daughter, who's taking care of her, taking care of her husband, and she resents it. The mother resents it. So very often, one person with caretaking needs will try to sabotage a relationship of a person with their mate so that she can maintain this stuff in her direction. I mean, it's like it becomes kind of vicious. It doesn't look sweet at all. It's like fighting for the one thing that's possibly available. And if you get caught in the middle of that, being caught between two things you're trying to take care of must be a terrible position. I'm sure many people go into that, right, Diana?
Absolutely. We've got dysfunctional families everywhere. I'm not sure that there are any families that are not dysfunctional. So what you're describing is to be expected. And within that expectation, if you have tools to communicate so that you can come up with agreements about what you will do in those circumstances, that's the way you can make life easier. Because, particularly if somebody is ill and they're getting Alzheimer's and their thinking isn't as clear as it needs to be, their reasoning powers, of course, there are going to be some irrational moves and statements and things that are going to transpire. It's to be expected. And when you know that, then it's a little bit freeing for you, because somebody else's expectation does not mean that it's something you have to act on. And if somebody else is upset with something, they have the right to be upset, and they can choose to be upset. But we can choose whether or not we want to play into that and respond to that.
Hmm. Very often, if you're the caretaker, if you're the caretakee, if you're the person who has a caretaker, part of what happens with your mind is your mind dissolves into a place where you start becoming dark, depressed, suspicious, and you begin turning these against the person taking care of you. You wonder if they're stealing your money. You wonder if they're doing things to you. And you turn against. So what's it like to be a caretaker who has the person they're taking care of turning against them and doubting them and being suspicious of them? What do you do with that?
Well, obviously, it's something that many caregivers are going to encounter at any given time. One example in my book, The Caregiving Wife's Handbook, was the driving issue for my husband, who really shouldn't have kept driving. And in speaking with his neurologist, we had to have this big discussion on this, and my husband thought that we were absolutely conspiring behind his back on that issue. So, you're going to face it more certainly with people with Alzheimer's and dementia. And you have to be clear in your own mind and in your own heart regarding what you were doing and why you were doing these things. And it's not easy. And that is why self-care is so critical for the caregiver. If you become an impaired caregiver, you're not going to be any help to anybody.
But it's kind of interesting that you say that, because one of the things that I know happens is a person starts, if you feel powerless taking care of someone, you might frequently decide to try to get help. So somebody comes along and you meet somebody and you'd start talking to them about how to take care of the person you're taking care of. So let's say it is your mother who's sick. You start talking to your mother's friends about, oh, she's really sick, I don't know how to take care of her. And then the mother begins hearing that you're talking about her. And that engenders further suspicion, like you had with your husband. There is something about carrying the decency of involving the person you're caretaking in every discussion and never talking behind their back that I think is for the benefit of the caretaker. It just doesn't pay to go around them to try to go to doctors and see what you could do. I don't think. What do you think?
Oh, I think both ways. For one, everything in the handbook is about having the effective communication. Absolutely. You bring the individual into the discussion and you discuss the concerns and come up with the strategies and how you're going to handle the situation. Certainly there are going to be times where you're going to be having experts involved in it, because the information may come from them. You know, the doctor's the one who may be telling you, look, your loved one cannot be doing this or that anymore. So the information comes from them, and your loved one is probably there in that appointment anyway. So you have to be discussing some of this with others, but you need to be a little selective. We talked before about support groups and how wonderful they can be, because it's a safe place with confidentiality. And you can say all the things in the uglier ways that you wish to say them, so that no one is going to be hurt. It doesn't go back, and your loved one, your sick person, doesn't hear these things. I think the discretion is certainly advised in all of this, that we don't want to be broadcasting all these concerns just to anybody who would listen, because it is private. Our privacy needs to be ensured, and the privacy of the one we're caring for needs to be ensured. It's common sense and it's compassion. We want to have compassion in this whole process for the sick person and for the caregiver.
I have a feeling that when you give that up and you start talking about the person you're caretaking to their friends and saying, I don't know what to do, he's sick, I think it's really anger. I think it's really the point at which you've turned to being so angry that, in effect, you're humiliating them. You're objectifying them. You're making them lesser beings by talking about them rather than including them. You know, when you suddenly hear, oh, when you hear from your accountant, oh, your wife was talking to me about how sick you are, you know there's something wrong.
It can be anger, but caregivers are given a new role in life, and they have no background in it.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times article that was done about the Caregiving Wife's Handbook was a roller coaster ride from hell, because caregivers are they have all these new roles just forced upon them, and they have no background in how to handle them. So while some people might be angry and go and talk to your mother's friends about, gee, I don't know how to handle it, I think probably more of it is genuine concern. You know, I don't know how to do this. You know, how should I talk to Mom? You know, what, you're her friends. Tell me what would she like? What is it that she would want? So I think it's more seeking assistance from people who know her. And, you know, if you know that one of them is a blabbermouth, you know, don't talk to that one. But if you know that some of them will have some discretion in what you discuss with them, then that would be the ones. But I'm not recommending that you do just go out and talk to the friends of the ill person.
Well, my suspicion is that most compulsive caregivers, which are people who have done it their whole lives, who turn their lives over to taking care of their parents and other people, are usually passive-aggressive. And my suspicion is that the passive-aggressivity comes out when they begin resenting, and it comes out in many different forms. And it becomes another way of getting to identifying the anger that you have that you've never really dealt with until that person, the caretaker, decides to recognize, acknowledge, and state their own anger and be able to talk about it as they recommend, as you recommend in your book. I should mention the name of the book is The Caregiving Wife's Handbook. Now, it sounds like it's about caregiving for wives or wives caregiving. This is a book that seems to be covered on all different levels. It's by Diana Denholm, D-E-N-H-O-L-M, Ph.D., from Florida. That's what we're listening to. Lisa, you had a question?
Well, it seems to me that for a caretaker, the feelings of shame that get stirred up about your how you need to protect yourself from the person who's you're losing, who's ill, or who's leaning on you, is something that you have to be able to talk about freely and also to be able to be in touch with.
Shame.
Yeah, that you need to distance yourself from the pain of what's going on with the person and from the arduous nature of taking care of them, that you feel ashamed of not being able to stay as connected as you might want to. Mm-hmm. And that you have to be able to talk about that, and you have to be able to, I think it's natural to almost dehumanize a person when they start to be sick and they're depending on you so much and you can't think of them as your loving other anymore. They're someone who's drifting away from you, and you can't be too connected to that.
Hmm. What do you think, Diana?
Excellent points. Guilt and shame are, you know, pretty much two sides of the same coin, and absolutely they're huge issues for caregivers. Emotions are neither good nor bad; they just are. And if we can just allow that to be, then we're going to be healthier. And there are ways that you can eliminate some of the excess extreme emotions. You'll get things out of your system in healthy ways. But you were talking about the passive-aggressive and our kind of career caregivers that, you know, do one generation to the next. And to me, that seems more of a chicken-egg issue. Are they passive-aggressive and then become caregivers, or are they passive-aggressive because they got stuck being caregivers for all, you know, so many years and years and years for different parents or aunts and uncles or whoever it may be? And, you know, not realizing they have a choice, their only way for them to act is to be passive-aggressive.
Well, the beauty about being in therapy is for their anger to be pointed out so that they could identify when they're angry, because most people who are like that can't even identify their anger. They don't know it. You know, it just happens to come out this way. You spill the breakfast tray on the person in bed, buddy. It was just an error. You know, but it might be a little deeper than that. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with quite a group of people here studying caregiving and being taken care of. The book, The Caregiver's Wife's Handbook by Diana Denholm. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue with this subject, and we'll talk about Paul Gilkey, who is very important in this discussion. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. Stay with us, Diana.
Okay.
Beautiful.
Ain't got no chains, ain't got no home. The sun goes down, it's getting cold. world left me homeless. I leave this damn world. The sun goes down. I'm getting scared. Don't let me down, my Lord, oh my. As darkness comes, forgive my sins. World left me homeless. I leave this damn world.
Group from the Czech Republic called Sunset Boulevard. When the sun goes down, just kind of what we deal with. This is Armand DeMille here with you. With the positive mind, we're talking about caregiving and care getting. We're going to talk about Paul Gilkey next with our guest, the book writer Diana Denholm, who wrote The Caregiving Wife's Handbook. We're going to be doing a three-hour special on May 15th on caregiving. We're going to go much more into each question in depth. You might want to make a note of it if you know of somebody who is involved in this. Make a note for May 15th at 1 o'clock. We're going to have quite a team of people talking about caregiving and care receiving. And this is something that's on everybody's plate. Here's the problem with a relationship. Whoever you are, somewhere in life, if you have a human relationship, you are going to be in the role of either being given the option to take care of somebody, or you're going to be the person who needs to be taken care of. And at that point, you're going to have to make a choice. And the choice is going to be either to be alone or to allow the relationship to continue or to check out. So these things will happen to just about everybody. And the only safe way is to stay alone. And I know people who have chosen to not have any relationships for fear of being possessed by someone who needs to be taken care of. And they say, I would rather be single because I got nobody to take care of. I'm accountable to nobody. I don't have to listen to my cell phone. I could ignore it if I want because my cell phone becomes a place of demand. They're not calling me. They're demanding of me. Those are usually the people who never answer their cell phones. So the number here, well, we're not going to give out any numbers because we're not taking any calls. We're with you today. We're going to continue with this. Let's go back with Diana Denholm. Diana, you're still here, I'm sure.
I'm still here.
How's your throat?
I can feel my throat.
You can feel that laryngitis sneaking up on you.
But I'd like to respond to a couple of things.
Yeah, go ahead.
The music that you have, it was wonderful.
Isn't that beautiful?
And I think it is very good for us to remember how soothing and healing the music can be, not only for the sick person, but for the caregiver. It's really important. And in terms of having, the person who stays alone, I remember a woman who had been a caregiver probably 30 years ago. And when her husband died, she never wanted to do that again. She thought, I just can't. But what she did was to deprive herself of living. I mean, there are no guarantees in life. And to not live because we're afraid of something that's going to happen is really sad. And part of the point of the Caregiving Wife's Handbook is to give people skills. You will learn how to handle these situations so that someone may be demanding something of you, but that doesn't mean you need to respond to it or do what it is that they ask. The people who, stay away from these situations are the ones who don't have any skills. And the skills are very simple, easy ones that anybody can learn that can turn your life around so that you can have a life and you can have relationships and you can have healthy ones because, you just never know what's going to come down the line. But we were going to be talking about Paul.
Before we do, let me just respond to what you just said.
Sure.
Because it's true, if you're in a caretaking situation and your mate, suddenly your new mate, gets in that situation, you can handle it one of two ways. Let me take care of it, I'll be the almighty. Or we better get help with that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you make yourself not be the almighty, but you allow yourself to designate somebody else to do the caretaking. See? And you do that from the get-go. You say, hey, you're going to need somebody else to pick up your socks because you can't pick them up anymore. Let's get somebody to pick up your socks. It would help the relationship tremendously and help not form the kind of resentment that is so easily accompanies this suddenly having this foist on you, So I think that's an important point, that one of the ways you can stop yourself from being caught in that position is from the get-go to say, we're going to need help with that.
I would agree. And what will happen with many, though, is that you, particularly with women, you get this terrible diagnosis and you jump in with both feet because your husband's life's at stake. And you want to do everything you can to protect him and make it better and make it go away and make him comfortable and all of this. So it's very common for the women to take on all the roles right away and want to be in charge of everything and everybody.
Yeah.
It's never too late to change that. I don't care how many years you are into caregiving, you can change that. And again, it's the communication where you will determine, you know, what things can be done by somebody else. It's no longer comfortable for me to handle this particular task with you. Let's get somebody in. So whether it's day one or it's year 10, it's never too late to change your behavior.
I guess it's the way it's presented.
Absolutely.
If you say to the person, look, you know this thing that I do for you? If you yell at the person, you said you were going to get somebody in to help you with this, and you're not doing it, that's one way. But if you say, look, we're at that point where I prefer that you bring somebody in to help you, it still stays on a loving level before it hits that resentment place. Because being a caregivee and looking at somebody hate you for taking care of you, it's probably got to be worse than being sick in itself. You know?
It's not an easy path. You know, even at its best, no matter how you slice it, it's not an easy path for the sick person or the caregiver.
Right.
And that's why they need all the help they can get.
Well, let's talk about Paul Gilkey.
Okay. Well, any caregiver, and you all relate to this in your family about when the Budinskys show up. Because the Budinskys, whether they're relatives, children, friends, family, at some point in time, they're coming. And, you know, you need to know what to do so that you don't have some bad things happen. And I'll tell you first about Marcia and Stan, who were 40-year-old widows when they met, and they had three children between the two of them that they, you know, as they merged their families. And he was a pretty cheerful guy, even though he was struggling with terminal cancer. But for Marcia, Stan's health was the biggest project of her life, and she'd pick his doctors and his treatment and oversee his food, his clothing, his exercise, his social activities, really every aspect of his life, and that worked wonderfully when just the two of them were home. But of course, as you caregivers know, children, relatives, and friends do come to visit, and when they visit, they second-guess everything you do. You know, why are you giving him that? You sure that's the best way to change the bandage? Why isn't he seeing my doctor? You know, my doctor's the best in the field. You know, he should be eating the special food that I brought, so get rid of yours, and on and on and on. And Marcia would complain, you know, who do they think they are? They aren't living this 24/7. They just waltz in here, spend a little time, then disappear before the hard work has to be done, and they think they know what it's really like. So some days she wanted to throw that special food at them or just throw them out of the house. Well, Paul Gilkey, in a small town in Ohio, could relate quite well to that. He was the primary caregiver for his wife, Darlene, who was dying of cancer. And one day, his two sisters-in-law and his son came to visit. And at lunch, as he did most days, he peeled an orange for her. And the sisters-in-law butted in and decided she should have tea and toast instead. And it wasn't the first time they butted in, but it did become the last straw. Because that day, after 3 hours of arguing, Paul got out his gun and shot and killed the two ladies and his son. And, of course, this is an extreme, and he had been a convicted murderer prior to that, so it, you know, really was an extreme. But what pushed Paul over the edge was not. It was simply over the lunch. But what you can do is that you can learn the tools so that you can anticipate, understand, and prevent these situations. And know also that the Budinskys have rights, too. You know, intrusions from family are to be expected. And whether your family relations are good and bad, you know, there's all levels of dysfunction out there, people want to help, and they want information. Children, no matter their ages, are going to face the loss of their father, and they may have the need and feel they have the right to know everything that's going on. And that is to be expected and respected, but not necessarily acted upon, because somebody else's need does not translate, as I said before, to being your husband's or your need. But this, again, is where you sit down and you talk with your loved one about, you know, how are we going to handle visits from your family? How are we, what information are we going to be giving? Are we going to tell everything about your condition? Are we only going to tell, you know, big reports? Are we going to give them good news only? You know, you need to talk about that and come up with agreements so that things don't go over the edge and push you over the edge, because we see now more and more in the paper of killings.
Around making toast. Just don't ever make toast.
That's right.
Hey, Diana, question
for
you.
Peeled orange.
A question for you. Talking about death. Do you ever have the conversations? I mean, the conversation I've always had with a sick friend when they have a fatal illness, I talk to them about death and they're so relieved. I say, okay, do you know you're dying? Or, yes, I know I'm dying, but nobody wants to talk about it. Everybody wants to say, I'll get better. What do you think of those conversations with, as from the caregiver to the caregivee?
I think they're an important conversation to have. We remember the story, the gift of the Magi, where I forgot the people's names, but Jim was the man, and he had a pocket watch which he sold so that he could buy hair brushes for his darling lady, I forgot her name, and she cut off her hair so that she could buy a watch fob for his watch. So they did these very loving gestures for each other, and, you know, it made a nice little story. But it was probably one of the biggest examples of poor communication out there.
Hmm.
And we have couples where they don't discuss any of these death issues with each other, and it's to their detriment. Kathy and Chris had this kind of circumstance where she didn't want to ever discuss dying with him because she wanted him to always think that he was going to get better. And he, from the flip side of it, was probably thinking, well, you know, I don't want to upset her and talk about my dying. So they never discussed it. And she, in particular, was kind of thinking that he didn't know he was going to die. Well, most people who are dying kind of have a clue. They, at some level, they sense that they're dying or that they're not dying. So you can just take that as a given. But what happened was they lost an opportunity to have intimate conversations about dying. They lost opportunities to discuss what would happen after he died, what would happen with finances, legalities, how would she live, all of these, you know, very practical things. But I think the most serious part was losing that intimacy, because the death discussions, as difficult as they are probably some of the most intimate discussions you can have with the person you love.
Beautiful discussion. It's a discussion that has tear-filled eyes and such affection, you know, without the denial, without the lies, even if it just comes from, I'm afraid you're dying, mm-hmm. you know, and the person saying, I'm afraid I'm dying too, and be able to hold each other with that truth. Magnificent, magnificent, so much better than the lies and denials that everybody carries on. Linda, you had a question.
I do, Diana. I have noted that oftentimes, for instance, if a spouse of somebody who is ill, they have their relationship, and then you'll have, as you mentioned, a visiting son or a visiting relative who comes in once or twice or three times a year. And during the time that the spouse, that the ill spouse is with this other son or a member of the family, they're more independent, and they take pride in what they're feeling is the caring coming from that child. And they'll get out, they'll become more independent, more mobile. And they seem to be, you know, and they will say, gee, you know, he helped me to get down. He helped me to get out. He helped me. And it was really, I really appreciated it. And oftentimes the spouse will sit back and say, gee, it seems like when I encourage him, or when I push him, he's looking at me like, what do you mean? You know, I can't do it. Why are you burdening me? So I hear that part and that, you know, what does a woman do, or a spouse, if it's a husband or a wife, in that kind of a relationship or in that kind of a scenario?
Very good question. That's a real common one. That's one of the hot buttons for the wives, or, you know, whoever the caregiver may be. Some of what happens there is that the sick person can rally a little bit more energy while that person, while their son or daughter is in town, but they can't sustain it. So they're really, you know, going all out to show, oh, look, I'm healthy, I'm strong, I can do all this and that. I guess for the caregiver is just, this is another one of those things that you can expect. Not take it personally, because this is a real common one. And this person, it's easier for this person to come in, the son or the daughter, whoever it might be, because they're not doing it 24/7, 365 days a year. So they also have more energy to be able to create a different atmosphere for the sick person. It's easier for them. They don't have the same connection as a spouse does. So unfortunately, it's one of those things that a wife caregiver just has to kind of expect and let it roll off like water off a duck's back.
It's such a difficult thing, understanding all of the dynamics behind it, which is why I guess you and Lisa Arnone do what you do as a profession, because there is so much to understand. So much to understand. And how do you do it without becoming hateful? That becomes the question, because I think what I've seen so often in caregivers is that they just become totally resentful. You know, they're there, they become either resentful or, like you said, Lisa, they're filled with shame. It's either I hate the person for having to take care of them, I hate myself being in this position, I have flights and fantasies that are going to run away and disappear. And that's one level. And the other is I'm ashamed of what I feel. How could I be feeling that way towards my own parent? And that's the toss-up. So talking about it, maybe not with the person who's sick, but being able to talk about it through support groups, by having therapists, by having somebody you can talk to, makes a huge difference. But then on the other hand, if you wind up talking to friends, they always want to give you advice. You should do this, you should do that, you should get out, you should do this. So we have two options. We have three options now. What are our three options? Go to therapy. Talk to your friends. But the best option of all is get the book, The Caregiving Wife's Handbook.
and go to the website.
And go to the website.
CaregivingWife.com, which has wonderful resources on it. And it also has very soothing background music on it. So while you are learning, you can also become soothed and calmed and comforted.
Now, did you like that one I sent you yesterday?
Yes, that was very good.
Being soothed and calm and comfortable. For Diana, that was your piece that you sent me that I passed along. Diana Thies, one of our listening audience. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We will not be with you tomorrow because it's what's called our Odd Wednesday. We will be back next Tuesday and Wednesday at 1 p.m., my friends. Diana, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for sharing all this wonderful information.
Fun. Thank you so much. I'll be back with you next Tuesday, my friends, 1 p.m. Thanks to everybody here, Lisa Arnone, Gianna Valerio, and Linda Vanello.